The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice?
Present.
Egbadje?
Present.
Bliss?
Present.
Gomez? Gomez? Hassan?
Present.
Heinrich? Heinrich? Hearn?
Present.
Juergens?
Present.
Olson?
Present.
Farr?
Present.
And Ryer?
Present.
And then I'll circle back here as I just saw Gomez.
Gomez present.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you. The next order of business is the approval of minutes from Tuesday, January 26th. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I will make that motion.
Representative Howard moves approval of the minutes. Any comments or additions or corrections? If not, members, please unmute yourselves for a voice vote. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We'll now move on to an overview on issues facing Minnesota renters. And members, we're probably going to have about six bills related to this issue. And so today is background for some of that work. So the presentation is such that it flows and probably makes sense to hear the entire presentation before we take questions. So if you have a question, maybe make note of it and hold it until we finish the agenda. We are going to begin with Amaryllis Carrion from Homeline and several Minnesota tenants. Ms. Carrion, please introduce yourself for the committee for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Houseman and members of the committee. My name is Amaryllis Carrion, and I'm a housing attorney with Homeline. Homeline runs a free tenant hotline that since 1992 has offered legal advice to over 260,000 Minnesota rental households throughout all 87 Minnesota counties. We were asked to prepare a presentation today to cover common issues that renters experience in Minnesota. So in a moment, I'll provide some context to who renters are in the state and begin to dive in into that overview. Later, you'll hear from other attorneys and community-based researchers about two of the most common issues we see, which are repairs and evictions. However, before we start, we felt that it would be most impactful to have two testifiers ground us in the direct experiences they have endured in their homes when faced with substandard conditions, threats of displacement, and eviction. These are two individual stories that, from our perspective, are a reflection of the thousands of clients we advise on a yearly basis who are impacted by similar circumstances. This committee has an obligation to address the massive gaps in the law and the barriers that the rental market has created. So I'd like to pass it over to Kalandra and Tamika, who will share their experiences.
Kalandra Chandler, do we have...
Seems she's not in right now, so we can pass it on to Tamika then.
Tamika Walton, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, good morning, Chairman of the House and members of the committee. My name is Tamika Walton. I really do appreciate and I'm thankful for this opportunity today. So my story is in 2017, an eviction was filed against me for non-payment of rent. My husband and I settled with the landlord after paying the rent. We paid during the eviction hearing, and so we settled everything. We didn't have any problems after that. We continued to live in the property for up to 3 years after this particular incident of the eviction being filed. After that, my husband and I have since divorced. Now I'm looking for a place to rent. And it's very troublesome. I've been staying with family, with my children. That's hard because, you know, staying with family, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't have the room, we don't have the space as needed. Some of us are, you know, we don't have the privacy that we're used to in regards to, you know, having to stay with family. It's concerning due to the fact that, you know, maybe overstaying our welcome there. We, during the last year and a half that I've been staying with family, also trying to find a place is hard and concerning because everyone is telling us that, you know, you have an eviction, you have an eviction, so they're not willing to rent to you as long as you have an eviction. And so, you know, it's very concerning in regards to you having an eviction, although we've paid, you know, and even continue to stay in a property for a number of years. That's pretty much my story. So I do want to say thank you for allowing me this time.
And so Ms. Walton, you're saying though the eviction was 3 years ago, it continues to stay on your record. And that's what, yes, what landlords would see as they consider
yes,
renting to you. Thank you for being with us. Let's check once more whether Kalando Chandler joined us. If not, I will turn it back to Ms. Carrion.
All right, Madam Chair, I've been working with Kalandra. I'm a tenant advocate at Homeline. Okay. She said that she's joining, but if it's not happening quickly enough for the meeting process, I'm happy to read her testimony. I have a copy of it.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Erin West. I'm a tenant organizer at Homeline.
Ms. West?
Yes.
Please continue.
Sure. I'll be reading the testimony of Kalandra Chandler. Good morning, all. My name is Kalandra Chandler, and I live at 4750 Central Ave Northeast in Hilltop near Columbia Heights. I am 47 years old and have been a renter for my entire life. In the past, I had some good experiences with landlords, but in recent years, I've had more trouble. Rents keep going up, but conditions keep getting worse. Landlords only seem interested in turning the highest profit instead of taking care of their tenants and property. Last winter, myself and 50 other tenants were displaced from my apartment in New Brighton when a large company purchased my building and gave eviction notices to everyone on New Year's Day. They wanted to flip the units and charge higher rent. My neighbors and I got together and organized against it, but the city supported the new owners over us tenants. I had to fight the eviction they filed against me in court and work to get it expunged. Eventually, I found a new place, but many of my neighbors weren't so lucky. Because of high rents, discriminatory screening, and other barriers to finding housing, some of them are still homeless a year later. Unfortunately, the only affordable option I found out turned out to be a nightmare. My current landlord in Hilltop doesn't make basic repairs. I haven't had proper heat all winter, and my neighbors are dealing with broken windows, ceiling leaks, and plumbing backups. No one is holding my landlord accountable because Hilltop has no rental license program. Now, my neighbors and I are organizing to take collective legal action and force our landlord to make repairs necessary for our health and safety. As a tenant, I have many rules I have to follow, or else I face the consequence of losing my housing. Bad landlords, on the other hand, get away with tenant abuses all the time. I don't think that's fair. Safe and affordable housing affects all areas of my life. I struggle with chronic health conditions and provide for a large family on a limited income. This pandemic has only made stable housing more important for my well-being. This year, I know thousands of renters like me in Minnesota are relying on the state to protect our housing stability and our health. I hope you keep me and my family in mind this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. West, for sharing that testimony from Kalando Chandler, a Minnesota tenant. And we'll go back to Amaryllis Carrion for additional comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So our hotline takes over 1,000 calls a month. We don't just serve the metro. For example, in 2020, over 20% of our calls were from tenants outside of the 7-county metro, and just under 30% of all Minnesotans live in rental housing. to work with our diverse clients. We have staff that's fluent in Hmong, Somali, and Spanish. And as a matter of fact, I am a Spanish speaker and handle most of the Spanish-speaking callers. In 2020 alone, I advised over 370 Spanish-speaking rental households. We prioritize working with these communities because people of color and renters with limited English proficiency are disproportionately impacted by substandard housing and harmful rental practices. We advise tenants in just about any rental question they have on more than 50 general topics. Now, most landlords and tenants in Minnesota really do get along. The vast majority of landlords and tenants are fair, decent people. There are roughly 15,000 residential evictions filed in a normal non-pandemic year, which is less than 3% of the rentals in Minnesota. Most disputes don't require court. We frequently work successfully with tenants to negotiate disputes and solve common issues such as repairs without pursuing legal action. The reason we have state laws and local regulations, though, is to create a level playing field and address a small percentage of harmful practices. We've had these laws since before we were a state, though. Landlord-tenant laws are never actually final. They have evolved over the last century, looking for an always shifting societally acceptable balance between the rights of landlords and those of tenants. Again, these laws have a disproportionate impact on people of color who comprise a much higher percentage of the rental population than owner-occupied housing. The issues that tenants contact our tenant hotline about are consistent year to year and throughout the state. They call us about needed repairs, evictions, landlords giving notices to vacate or lease non-renewals, security deposit disagreements, questions about terms and provisions on the lease, fees built into their leases, and inquiries about when a landlord is allowed to enter their home, among dozens of other frequent topics. As I previously mentioned, the actual law, landlord-tenant law, has to remain fluid. Times change. What was acceptable in the 70s and 80s when many of our current landlord-tenant statutes were enacted, it's just no longer sufficient. And Minnesota renters now have, in many cases, substantially fewer rights than tenants in other states. Some of our landlord-tenant statutes are much older than that. Much of the framework for our eviction rules are from when Minnesota was a territory. So when we look at state laws and local ordinances, there's just a lot of work to be done for Minnesota to achieve a modern balance between the rights of landlords and tenants. And this type of forward thinking, rebalancing, is just necessary in Minnesota. We know this because we are now starting to witness an era of cities feeling no option but to enact their own landlord-tenant laws. This is relatively new, and although many cities do have rental codes that require landlords to secure rental licenses, as well as direct city inspectors to personally monitor the conditions in rental units, in general, cities haven't really worked to pass landlord-tenant laws in Minnesota. The state has been the final answer on landlord-tenant law. An example of this is the testimony that Erin just read to us from Calandra. She was a resident in New Brighton, and her experience just shows us this. Talking about New Brighton, they are not alone. In the last few years, several cities have passed tenant protection ordinances similar to New Brighton to respond to the impact of apartment sales on the housing stability of thousands of renters. Multiple cities have passed their own ordinances dealing with Section 8 voucher acceptance, which, by the way, other cities have expressed interest in following. They have also passed tenant screening and security deposit regulations and just cost eviction protections for tenants at the end of their lease. Right now, St. Louis Park just enacted a new ordinance requiring landlords to give a pre-eviction filing notice. As a matter of fact, that ordinance becomes effective on Monday. Cities are stepping in because at the state level, landlord-tenant law has simply not kept up. if state landlord-tenant law can't remain flexible enough to change over time, cities have shown that they will adapt. And really, they're only responding to these issues that are directly impacting their communities because the state has not taken on substantive reforms to landlord-tenant law. Now, by statute, the Attorney General's office is required to prepare an annual statement of landlord-tenant laws for Minnesota residents for both landlords and tenants to consult. This document is available through the Attorney General's website, and they will also mail it to those who request it. It would have to grow substantially if we're going to have a patchwork of laws from city to city throughout Minnesota. So now to give an overview of a tenancy and the laws, as well as gaps in protections that we often hear about, we're going to just take a quick glance chronologically from the beginning to the end of a tenancy. Here are some of the issues that Minnesota renters contact us about regularly. At the beginning, tenant screening plays a massive role in whether a tenant will ever qualify for a rental unit. I want you to think back. Think back and remember when you last rented. Landlords used to do reference checks, and then came tenant screening agencies, and now we have the internet. Screening on a whole host of matters is just commonplace. A renter carries their history with them to every landlord they try to rent from, no matter how long ago the bad record applies to. Many criteria have a disproportionate impact on Black and Indigenous and households of color. Examples of criteria that we observe screening our clients out of housing opportunities include rental, criminal and credit history, and income level. Often our clients may have artificial lower credit scores due to the fact that their positive rental payment history is simply not reflected by the credit bureaus. One entire group of tenants that we've seen categorically excluded from a large portion of the rental market are those who hope to use a rental subsidy program like a Section 8 voucher to help pay for their rent. You only need to do a brief Craigslist search, just the briefest of searches, for apartments to rent anywhere in the state to see listings declaring Section 8 not apply. Studies have shown that this can greatly limit housing opportunity and choice of location, sometimes making only a fraction of vacant units available to those households. On affordable security deposit, application fees, along with first and sometimes last month's rent, are other common obstacles tenants face in securing a rental home. And this can add up for an applicant who may have to pony up several thousands of dollars before they ever get the keys to a home. This is yet another place where Minnesota is falling behind. Many other states regulate the amount that can be charged for security deposits. And some cities in Minnesota actually are now taking action to address this issue as it has such a direct impact on the affordability and accessibility of housing. Now, the next step in a tenancy is actually entering into and agreeing to a lease. Unfortunately, due to the nature of the landlord-tenant relationship, particularly for our lower income clients, there is a significant power imbalance, and we frequently see tenants agreeing to unenforceable terms. Even though these lease terms might be counter to the law, tenants still are regularly harmed by them. In residential leasing, the reality is that landlords always write the lease, and tenants rarely have any meaningful ability to negotiate any of the terms in the contract that the landlord presents. Leases are sometimes one page, but it's not unheard of to sometimes have leases that are closer to 50 pages with lots of complicated clauses. Tenants contact us regularly, trying to simply understand what the rental contract actually means. Many times there are confusing mandatory fees built into the lease, and landlords have increasingly relied on mandatory fees built into the leases instead of simply raising rent to cover their cost. They just tack on fees, many times not disclosed until the lease is revealed and you're well into the process. And after the tenant has already paid an application fee, which is typically between $25 and $50 per adult. The types of fees we see our tenants required to pay typically have very vague sounding names like administrative fee or lease processing fee. As a matter of fact, one very large landlord in the state has a January fee. Every January, their tenant owes an additional $100. Why? Because it's January and it's in the lease. Change in lease terms, change in ownership, rent increases, utility charges, shared meters, utility shutoffs, retaliation, CRP and renter's credit, pets, guests, rental licensing, neighbors and roommates, other mid-lease issues are some of the other areas we commonly see at the hotline. A troubling issue that comes up mid-lease, though, it's very troubling for me and for the hotline, really, is when can a landlord use a key to enter a tenant's home? And this is an especially important question now during the pandemic. Privacy violations into a tenant's home can range from just a mere annoyance where the landlord didn't provide ample advance notice to enter the unit. But then there are intrusive and unsafe abuses. For example, we've had clients whose landlords have walked in on them while they're in the shower or asleep. Minnesota's privacy law on when a landlord can enter a rental unit legally is both outdated and vague. For example, instead of requiring that a landlord merely give reasonable notice, which is what our statute currently has, the statute could require a 24-hour notice like many other states already require. See, the crux of the issue is that we have not defined what reasonable notice is, which creates a very complex gray area, and the legislature must address this. Habitability issues are annually the top reason tenants contact our tenant hotline. We field thousands of inquiries each year, from infestations to mold to substandard conditions and lack of heat on cold days just like today. I just looked and it's 13 degrees outside. My colleague, Lawrence McDonough, will be addressing more of this in depth in a moment. The last phase of the tenancy, though, is whether there can be a, through a much, I'm sorry, the, whether the it is through a mutual termination agreement or through other means such as evictions, lease terminations or notices to vacate, lease non-renewals, or even other egregious situations such as condemnations or rental license revocations. That part will be discussed by Dr. Brittany Lewis and Joey Dobson. They will dig into it with more experience and detail about the Minnesota eviction process. But I will just mention that evictions and involuntary and formal displacements are the second most common issue that we advise about after repairs in our hotline. And from what you have heard from Calandra's statement and Tamika's testimony, these issues are very real and have very direct consequences for families. For most tenants, the last issue that arises during their tenancy is after they've vacated, trying to recover their security or damage deposit. This is the third most common issue we hear from renters. As discussed, typically this is a full month's rent, if not more. Many tenants pay 2 times their rent or more for a deposit when they move in. Most deposit disputes arise out of a landlord claiming that a tenant caused damage that's beyond ordinary wear and tear. This is by far the most common reason that tenants sue landlords in Minnesota. So our state does have useful protections and regulations in this area. However, it can often be challenging, both in the amount of time and effort to get into court, and because of how intimidating the court can be for low-income renters, just to navigate the court process to challenge a wrongly held deposit. So we see landlords take advantage of this situation, effectively making it a standard business practice to withhold deposits or insert unenforceable automatic deductions from the deposit. Now, I've just gone chronologically with the issues Homeline deals with. I welcome any questions you might have, and I want to thank you, Chairman Hausman, and the committee members for the opportunity to speak to today. So now I will turn it over to Larry McDonough from Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law, who will go over issues of habitability.
Thank you for your testimony. We're joined now by Larry McDonough, a lawyer from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Laurie McDonough. I'm senior Minnesota counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I'm one of the old people in the room here. I've been doing landlord and tenant law since 1983. I probably have about 10,000 former clients. I first worked at Legal Aid doing in both central Minnesota and in the Twin Cities. And then I later worked at Dorsey & Whitney. And now I'm at the Lawyers Committee. And my job at the Lawyers Committee is to provide training for judges and attorneys and law students around the state in landlord-tenant law. I also teach at the University of Minnesota and maintain the website Housing Law in Minnesota. And I've also been a landlord off and on since 1986. So besides representing landlords and tenants, I've been a landlord and a tenant and understand those sides of the equation. You know, we have some good habitability laws in Minnesota, but there are gaps, and that's what we're here to talk about today. Our covenants of habitability, now in 504B161, is one of the early modern landlord-tenant statutes. It goes back to 1971, and it has a lot of strong things in there to say landlords need to maintain the property in reasonable repair, fit for the use intended by the parties, and in compliance with local codes. But it doesn't really get into the specifics of it. It doesn't list different things. So it's more kind of a general kind of floor of apartment conditions. I was a member of the Governor's Commission on Affordable Housing in 1989. And in that, I part of my job was to propose some changes. And I proposed the housing courts that we have in Hennepin and Ramsey County, the rent escrow action, which is for non-emergencies, and the emergency tenant remedies actions for emergencies. So what are the problems? Well, first of all, most landlords are good landlords. Most drivers are good drivers. We don't need laws for most people to know that they should drive slowly in a residential neighborhood where kids are playing. But we have laws to penalize people that don't think that way. And so we need that in the landlord-tenant area as well for the landlords that, as were discussed earlier, don't want to follow the law or don't see it as part of their cost-benefit analysis to do that. So what are some of the problems that we have in habitability right now? Well, heat is one of the major ones. That probably shouldn't be a big surprise given where we live. The home line receives hundreds of calls each year about lack of heat or inadequate heat. I've had many cases involving that, and it's certainly, besides just being uncomfortable, it can really be serious for people with respiratory conditions and for kids. And around the state, you might think, for those of you that live in the Twin Cities, that every place has a housing code and every place has a minimum heat threshold. But they're actually pretty rare around Minnesota, and it creates this real hodgepodge of cases where places where you can have a 68 degree requirement in one place and no requirement somewhere else, or just that the facilities work, but that they don't maintain a certain level of heat. So that's really a big problem. There are other emergencies that aren't really adequately addressed by our laws right now. As I mentioned, I worked on the creation of the Emergency Tenant Remedies Action. And back then we created a list and thought that that list would probably be adequate for the time. Emergencies would be loss of running water, hot water, heat, electricity, sanitary facilities, things like that. But over the years, we've run into a lot of cases where the courts, not seeing certain problems on the list, don't think they fit into that case. And Homeline gets a lot of complaints each year about things like the refrigerator not working. Now, some people might think, well, that's not an emergency, but, you know, it's not 13 degrees year-round here. And in the summertime, if you don't have adequate refrigeration, your refrigerator isn't working. It's a food issue. It could be a medication issue. Air conditioning not working. Now, landlords generally don't have to have air conditioning, but if they do have air conditioning and it's not functioning, that can be an emergency. You might be thinking, well, okay, we'll put on, you know, just wear less clothing. I had a case one time with a client who had a disability where she did not perspire, which meant she internalized her heat. And when the air conditioning wasn't working, it was essentially a life-threatening condition for her. I had a case one time where we had a notice of intent to condemn the property. And seemed to me that was an emergency, but the referee in that case said, well, it's not on the list. It's not an essential service. So I don't think this is the right type of case for that. We also have problems with elevators and serious infestations. In my mind, all these are emergencies, and it would certainly provide clarity for the bench and for landlords and for tenants to have laws that said so. Another gap in my mind is that landlords that don't maintain their property that cause serious injury or death have very limited personal injury liability for that. And that's really based on a series of court decisions that, in my view, I think misread some of our habitability laws. I last want to just talk a little bit about how habitability issues are treated in the court system from a procedural standpoint. I've mentioned the rent escrow case. That's a case for non-emergency repairs. The filing fee for most of those cases is $70, while the filing fee for an emergency tenant remedies action, where we really time is of the essence, it's a $300 filing fee. And while some people with low incomes can get that fee waived, there are a lot of folks that experience habitability problems that are not of the lowest incomes. And so they might have to pay that $300 filing fee to deal with the fact that their heat isn't working right now. Another problem in the court system right now is how habitability issues are treated in the context of eviction cases. Now, the good news is that our Supreme Court, very soon after the habitability statute was passed in 1971, laid out a framework for when tenants can raise habitability issues in different types of cases. And one of those is in defense of an eviction case for non-payment of rent. There are a lot of judges and referees around the state that require tenants to pay rent into court to defend whether they owe rent or not, even where tenants have used some of that rent to deal with the lack of repair problems. Now, you might be thinking, well, if they haven't paid the rent, why shouldn't they have to pay the rent into court to defend that case? Well, most types of civil litigation in Minnesota do not require a defendant to put money into court to defend liability. Like if I were being sued saying I'm a construction worker and I didn't do the right kind of work on a house and I'm getting sued for maybe $5,000. I'm not required to put that $5,000 into court to defend myself and say that I actually did good work here. And so this is a real disincentive for tenants to raise legitimate habitability issues when they're not able to pay that rent into court because they may have used it for some other things, and they may have used it for things related to the habitability problems they're experiencing. So I want to make sure that I keep us on track here. And so I'm going to stop talking now. You see, lawyers can actually voluntarily stop talking. And so I'm going to do that now, and we'll kind of move on to our next speaker.
And you'll be around for questions later as
yes,
well.
I will.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And do we now have Dr. Brittany Lewis, University of Minnesota Center for Urban and Regional Affairs with us? Dr. Lewis, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello. My name is Dr. Brittany Lewis. I'm CEO of Research in Action, a senior research associate at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the Humphrey Institute.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. So my center conducted a two-year study on evictions, which we completed in 2019. Single Black mothers face the highest risk of evictions in the United States. From 2013 to 2015, approximately 50% of renter households in North Minneapolis had experienced at least one eviction filing, mostly in the 55411 and 55412 zip codes, despite the fact that these zip codes only contain just 8% of all the city's rental housing. I would argue that North Minneapolis, like a lot of urban areas adjacent to downtown, have been communities manufactured to reproduce housing discrimination, issues of urban disinvestment, unfair lending practices, disproportionate evictions. And the situation is exacerbated with the rise of distressed property investment. Single Black mothers with children living under the poverty line lead more than 60% of Black households. in this community. And as a result, 67% of the residents are in some kind of county or federal government assistance, literally living one crisis away from losing their housing. I also think it's really important to demystify what an eviction is, because I think when you hear the word eviction, we think it elicits the vision of a sheriff knocking on someone's door with a writ of eviction and a group of folks removing their belongings. And the reality is, in most cases, that's not actually what happens. For all the folks that we interviewed in our study, only 22% of the tenants interviewed had a writ of removal, meaning someone actually forcibly removed them from the property. A more holistic definition shows that, you know, most folks, and about 25% of the folks that we interviewed were living in the place that they were evicted from, which is a tactic of some landlords that makes it impossible for you to actually leave the property itself. I think what was really important for us to highlight in the report was that choice is an illusion when the context in which you're making a decision is always, always under a state of duress, mediated with those that have more power over your material life than you often do. So where survival rather than personal and familial growth and advancement is at the center of your thinking. So I want to give you a sense of the context for tenants. So only 4 out of the 68 tenants that we interviewed said that they selected the house that they were evicted from because they desired to be there. You know, most were not forced to choose a location because of homelessness or desperation. 38 declaratively stated that it was not their first choice. 29 stated that the property they were evicted from was their first choice, but then went on to explain it was their only choice because they were homeless and they selected the property out of desperation. So literally out of the total 68, only 4 actually selected the property because it was their first choice. So choice is an illusion in this context when we're thinking about the notion of choosing and rationality. So understand the context under which many tenants are finding themselves. And the Minneapolis Innovation Team report evictions in Minneapolis say that nearly 93% of the city's evictions filings were for non-payment of rent, right? Similarly, of the 68 tenants we interviewed, 81% of their evictions were filed for non-payment of rent. However, we went a little deeper to demystify what non-payment of rent even really means from the perspective of those most impacted. So from the perspective of landlords, both nonprofit and for-profit, most stated that because they cannot get the support from local law enforcement to appear in housing court, particularly for lease violations, filing non-payment of rent becomes the easiest way to get rid of quote-unquote problem tenants. What is not captured in this analysis and existing literature are the ways that non-payment of rent is being used by many to disproportionately evade tenant rights to be free from retaliation. So there's 2 Minnesota laws that protect tenants from retaliation by landlords. One applies when a landlord seeks to terminate a tenancy as a penalty for a tenant's attempt to enforce rights. The other bans retaliatory evictions under the Tenant Remedies Act. So of the 68 tenants we interviewed, 21%, which is 14 reported cases, could have fell under the anti-retaliation provision under the Tenant Remedies Act. 10%, 7, fell outside of that limiting framework, but provided insight into potential gaps, meaning we interviewed a number of folks who were either being sexually harassed or sexually pursued by their landlords, and then later evicted because they refused those advances. I also was later asked to be an expert witness in a case connected to sexual harassment by a landlord. So this is a very real thing that isn't really supported under the Tenant Remedies Act currently. Of the 47 interviews remaining, a majority of whose cases were filed for non-payment of rent, tenants say that the fact that their eviction filing was spurred by other factors. What other factors? 22% said job loss, decreased income, or lack of resources. 18% landlord disputes and/or mismanagement. A number of the landlords that I interviewed, I would say 80% or more said they fell into the work. They're not historic property managers or work in the area of construction. Most of them bought their properties during the downturn of the market, 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12. They would admittedly say that they would rent to anyone who would fog a mirror or say that there was a learning curve for them in trying to learn what it meant to be a landlord. So mismanagement is a real thing that was happening to tenants, and they really didn't have the power to resist some of that mismanagement or learning curve. 13% was a result of domestic violence. health crisis or death, 7% conduct on premise, and only 7% said they simply didn't pay rent, meaning it's never about the house. Let's also be clear. Maintaining the structure is really what it's about. It's mental health, it's income, it's family support. There's a number of other things that go into your ability to maintain a home. People aren't just sitting around saying, I just don't want to pay my rent. So I just want to like be really clear about that. So I want to share a few stories with you and direct quotes from folks. One thing that's really hard to track is informal evictions, which is, you know, happening constantly. I met a gentleman at housing court and he stated the following to me. They, the housing inspector, just told me to get my stuff. I got 15 minutes to get my stuff. The building's condemned. Don't take everything. They gave me a card and told me I had to come back and get the rest of my stuff. I was feeling suicidal. I told him, the city inspector, I called the crisis team and I went to Hennepin County yesterday and I stayed in the psych ward last night because I was feeling suicidal because it should never have happened to me. I met this gentleman the day after he checked himself out of the psych ward at housing court and he still had his bracelet on. He was a former addict. He had gone through a transitional living program and he got his first apartment and he was very proud of that apartment. And you can only imagine the condition of that apartment if the city came to condemn it. That also means the city didn't do its due diligence to hold landlords accountable to keeping their properties up to code, because this gentleman, who had finally got his life back together, all he wanted was a drink. It is more than the house. It is more than the structure. Tenants are experiencing things on multiple levers. I've interviewed a number of folks who said that landlords would show them properties, some of which were boarded up, still had, whether it was clothes left behind, furniture, dead rats, feces, and other things. They would go in and clean it up just for a roof. They would go in and clean it up with promises of getting a credit on their rent or lease, which never was in writing, of course. And then they would have disputes with their landlord about this credit and refuse to pay. It was never in writing. So then they have multiple UGs on their records. It's also a thing that's happening a lot. You know, tenants who are working in a low wage sector are making a handshake and a deal agreements with landlords because they feel like they have no other choice, but it requires this landlord to actually follow the honor system. But they can evict you at any time. It's so common. One woman I met who had worked for Target for almost 20 years, she found out she had breast cancer, went on disability, but let's just be honest about the time in which corporations take to then transfer your actual payments over to disability. It took them over 2 months to do this. And at that point, she wasn't able to keep up her rent. They evicted her multiple times. So she got a UD, then she got another UD, and then she went to housing court and took out a payment on her 401k. Just to try to stay in this place. It's never about the house. It is so much deeper than the structure itself. You know, I believe deeply in our ability to move beyond data points and get right to the heart of the stories and the intersections that are failing the people that we claim we're serving. We're talking mental health, we're talking code enforcement, we're talking corporate process and disability, we're talking about a lot of intersections here. And I think we need to bring back the tenant story, the tenant perspective, because there's an illusion of choice for a lot of folks, holding to folks that have more power in their lives, you know, than they do themselves sometimes. And how are we supporting them at the state level to ensure they have the right advocacy, support within those processes? The last story I'll share with you, I remember doing an interview with an elder Black woman in her 60s. She was a foster mother of two children who had cancer. She was about to get evicted. And we're sitting in our kitchen having this interview. And as she cries, telling me the story, I'm not knowing what she's gonna do. She takes her children to the children's hospital. They have regular appointments there. I think for some form of transfusion. She says, I'm sitting there and I'm crying and the nurse keeps asking me what's wrong. And she said, at first, I was really uncomfortable sharing. Let's also be clear, asking for help is hard. Asking for help is also hard when you feel like it's demeaning to ask for help because people don't treat you like a human. She went down to Hennepin County Emergency Assistance to apply for that assistance. And she talked about how sad that made her feel. The questions they asked of her, how it felt like she was begging. They didn't make her feel like they were here to help her. So when the people at the Children's Hospital asked her, like, what's wrong, she was nervous to share. She finally shared. And then she learned right there on the spot that there was some kind of cancer release fund that Children's Hospital gives to families in like dire economic situations. They wrote her a check right there. But it took Hennepin County over 30 plus days to ever tell her if they were gonna help her at all. And she sat there as we cried, and she said, I didn't know what I was gonna do. I'm a foster parent. I can't have these kids out on the street. But unless she wouldn't have, you know, swallowed her pride that day and said something to the nurse at the Children's Hospital, who then told her about this relief fund that the Children's Hospital had, who knows where her and those foster children would have been. It's more than the house. It's far beyond that. And I hope we keep that in mind, that our work is people work, and that we don't forget that.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move on to a final testifier before we go to questions, and that is Joey Dobson from Legal Aid. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Ms. Dobson, are you there? I don't know if we lost her or if she's on mute. Ms. Dobson?
She is here. I see her on the screen. She's got a headset on and does not look like she's muted, but she might be having some trouble with her microphone.
Good morning. Can you hear me now, Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for being with us. Please, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joey Dobson, housing policy attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides civil legal services for people facing issues regarding housing, as well as family law, immigration, disability rights, public benefits, and other civil legal matters. As part of our housing team, I've represented tenants in eviction cases, repair cases, housing subsidy terminations, and other types of housing cases. I'm here to just very briefly talk about how the court eviction process works. We know there are many, many landlords who work excessively with their tenants. They're flexible, they work things out when there are issues. And we do, of course, also have a court eviction process for when it is needed. And there are some landlords who are less inclined to work with their tenants, as we've heard stories about today, and are less inclined to work things out amicably outside of court. So what I'll talk again just very briefly is about the system as it is, the rules that govern how evictions work when they do happen. So as has been explained today already, evictions in Minnesota are generally governed by state statute, now Chapter 504B. These court statutes have remained largely unchanged since 1858, as Ms. Carrion mentioned earlier today, when Minnesota gained statehood. Early on, eviction cases were categorized as summary proceedings or short proceedings. And here in Minnesota, eviction cases are very short. Minnesota, in fact, has one of the shortest eviction court procedures in the country. The whole process at its fastest can take as little as 8 days from the initial court filing to the order telling the sheriff to remove a family from their home. Again, I mentioned this timeline has stayed largely the same since 1858, and yet in that time period since then, we've come a long way in legally acknowledging rights for renters. There's the Human Rights Act in 1967, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, Fair Housing Act in 1968. We've heard some of the laws that Minnesota has passed to protect renters' rights against retaliation. The Violence Against Women Act
1994 provide crucial protections for survivors of domestic abuse. And we have a number of housing subsidy programs that are governed by regulations for lease requirements and terminations. But despite these monumental changes since 1858, the court timeline has remained summary or short. We just briefly what happens in this timeline, as has been mentioned before, Minnesota landlords are not required to provide a notice before going to court to file an eviction. Many landlords do. It is good practice for landlords to work with their renter before going to court, but it's not required by law. So if there's a problem, the case is filed and is public the minute that it is filed. And this is before a renter necessarily even knows about the problem or the case. So once the renter family does get notice, statute requires that the case be served 7 days before the court hearing. They come to court. In the second and fourth judicial districts, there's specialty housing courts, which in normal times, housing court is a very packed, stressful place to be. A typical court calendar would have about 45 cases on for an afternoon. And they're just people packed in together making stressful decisions on the spot about their case. Current law presumes that a full-blown trial will happen at that very first court appearance. If your appearance is on a Monday, the court can only continue that case for up to 6 days. So this process is really fast. The state statute only allows the court to continue that trial 6 calendar days, which is, you know, barely enough time for a family to get a babysitter and make arrangements to go to court, let alone get a lawyer who is versed in fair housing and state statute, federal subsidy guidelines. In Minnesota, you know, most civil cases take months, if not years. But here we say you should be ready to stand trial for your home in less than a week. Mr. McDonough spoke about the health and safety rights and responsibilities provided for by Minnesota statute. And I just want to point out again that the barrier that for folks raising health and safety hazards in their home, they are required to often post the entire amount of alleged rent due into court in order to have their day in court, in order to make their case before a judge. So at Legal Aid, you know, we represent thousands of renters each year. A number of cases have, we identify rights that the renter has to the case, defenses to the case. But what's really just important to highlight is the process is so fast that most renters end up signing on the dotted line, you know, agreeing to move out without having a chance to meaningfully put on their case to the court. Again, Dr. Lewis and others, Ms. Carrion mentioned the impact of an eviction on a person's record. We know in Minnesota that one eviction is upstream from another, potentially upstream from the next landlord who you're forced to rent from, who doesn't respect your rights as a family and your privacy. And so we support proposals to prevent evictions and to make them more fair. As has been discussed before, you know, the system takes disproportionately Black, Indigenous, and people of color, parents, kids, saddles them with an eviction record, and in many cases forces people to live in unhealthy situations moving forward. And so what do we predict is coming in this time, the pandemic and coming after the various moratoria are lifted or altered? The U.S. Census Bureau currently estimates that there are approximately 80,000 Minnesota families facing eviction based on being behind on rent. In a typical year, as was mentioned, there are about 15,000 eviction filings each year. So this means if the moratorium on most cases was lifted tomorrow, the courts would be overloaded with 4 to 5 times the number of cases they're used to handling in a year. And again, as we mentioned, we at Legal Aid, you know, our role is to represent renters and to have their rights heard. Most landlords are responsible. We, you know, work with all the responsible landlords to think about how to make the system more fair and what makes sense. We're in regular communication with the Multi-Housing Association and thinking about what makes sense for all the parties involved. And unfortunately, there simply are landlords who don't follow best business practices and respect the rights of the families they rent to. So thank you again, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to be with the committee today. Happy to answer any questions about the eviction process, along with the other testifiers that are here today. So thank you, Madam Chair.
How are renters informed about the court filing fee? How do they find out about that fee and when in the process?
About the landlord's filing fee?
Does the renter pay? The renter pays a court filing fee, is that correct?
So at the end of the case, so initially in order to file a case, the landlord must pay the court the filing fee. And then depending on what happens with the case, the tenant can be required as part of a settlement agreement, or if they lose the case, to pay the landlord, to reimburse the landlord for that court filing fee.
I see. Okay. Okay, members, we'll move to questions, and all of the testifiers are available to answer, and we'll just assume the appropriate person will step forward offering the answer. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. First on the list is Representative Herr.
Representative Herr.
A little bit there to unmute it. Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
I can.
Perfect. Chair Houseman, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you so much for giving these issues a full hearing and investing so much time into this. As I've mentioned in committee before, that housing is really important to me. And I just wanted to bring up the fact that I do have three bills that I hope will be coming before this committee, because I do believe that tenants deserve privacy in their own home. The tenants should have more rights regarding emergency repairs, and that everyone deserves to live in have a warm place to live. And I'm looking forward to having greater discussions around these issues with you and with this committee. And I just wanted to say thank you again for your thoroughness in giving this topic the hearing and bringing forward individuals who have been advocating and working hard within this field. That there's much that we need to do, and that for us to continue to move forward. And I didn't have as much of a question, but just a comment, because I don't want that to get lost in the fact that housing is one of our biggest issues of our time. And yet, we know very much so how small of our budget is allocated to this type of work. And I just wanted to commend your commitment to doing this, Chair Houseman. So I just wanted to make sure we didn't lose that point in all of this.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I think I don't know if it was last year, you had a bill that we weren't able to get through the process, in which if a tenant, a renter, suddenly had a disability that meant they couldn't live independently in their apartment anymore, that they would be able to get out of their lease in, what was the time frame, a year or two? I mean, in other words, you were generous and said, they can't move out immediately the next day, but they can get out of their lease in a year.
Yes, and Chair Houseman, that bill is coming. The three I talked about were three specific bills around tenant rights. But you're right, I'm bringing that one forward, and I actually have two other ones too. And I just dropped those this week, and so hopefully they'll be coming along with potentially an equity package around tenant protection rights as well. And so I have quite a few things coming forward, but I just wanted to thank you so much for continuing to create this space for us to do this.
Well, that was a particular disappointment for me, because it's always a surprise when you see a bill like this. You think there's no way for this person who now has a disability to get out from under their lease. Anyway, we always get educated through the introduction of bills.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, if I could just jump in for a moment. Yes. Larry McDonough again with the Lawyers Committee. The bill provided for a 2-month notice, and this was for renters that had a physician-certified medical condition, illness, or disability that hindered the right to remain in their current housing. So right now, if someone dies, their personal representative can then end the lease with a similar notice. But currently, there isn't that right for people that are, have a disability or are declining.
Thank you. Mr. Wirth.
Madam Chair, next on the list is Representative Howard.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to all the testifiers today for painting kind of a broad picture in this space. And I was struck by a lot of the discussion was centered on what Minnesota renters were facing before we faced a global pandemic. And Ms. Dobson commented on this a little bit about what we're facing in the midst of the pandemic. And I'm wondering if any testifiers would share what you're hearing from renters amidst the pandemic and concerns. Obviously, we do have an eviction moratorium, thank goodness, here in Minnesota currently. But what are you hearing from renters and what are your fears? Or what do you expect to happen if the eviction moratorium is lifted without any sort of legislation in its place?
We have anyone willing to step forward here?
Madam Chair, if I may just briefly.
Ms. Dobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Howard, for that question. I mentioned briefly the statistics that we know about folks who are behind on rent. I think it's just really important to think about all the ways that the COVID-19 pandemic and related economic crisis have impacted so many of us, possibly all of us, in ways that are not due to any of our own, overt action or our own faults. So in addition to the economic piece that we laid out, I just wanted to also highlight that we are certainly grateful for the state eviction moratorium in place right now. There are significant exceptions to that moratorium as it exists now. Legal aid is in court every day right now, defending folks who are facing evictions that have been filed. Some, perhaps reasonably, and some that are kind of forced into these exceptions. And we're in court every day defending against those. And I just want to highlight the disparate impact of the nature of some of the exceptions that are there for, very rational reasons, but there's a disparate impact. We know that people of color specifically are more likely to face allegations of conduct-related behavior, whether it's public safety, criminal activity, we know that. And so I just wanted to point out that there are evictions happening right now, and we are representing as many of those as we possibly can. And I fear that if any moratorium is lifted without a thoughtful transition, the disparities in our society would just be kind of exacerbated. We know who would be less likely to find a lawyer on short notice. We know who would be more likely to face allegations that they might not be equipped to defend it against and might not have as many options for alternative housing. So just brief answer to your question, happy to answer more questions in more detail offline.
Thankfully, we have had the $100 million in this past year for housing assistance, and the federal government is again in its CARES Act doing more of that. Follow-up, Representative Howard.
I guess what I would say is, if there's anyone else that wants to answer that, it looks like we might have someone that might have a comment, and then I might have a follow-up.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on what we are seeing.
Ms. Carrion.
What we are seeing at the hotline. There's a lot of privacy and intrusion issues. Landlords are and their agents are entering homes, especially not wearing masks. The Attorney General is the one who's in charge of enforcing that provision of the executive order, but there are issues with that. And people who are immunocompromised, landlords who want to do repairs in units or are just doing repairs in adjoining units, causing issues with people who are immunocompromised or just people who are working from home. And then it's extremely difficult to get out of a lease mid-year right now. And landlords are using this time, obviously for a good reason to do improvements. And it is in fact affecting a lot of our clients.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I really see our mission this session in housing related to COVID as twofold. We need to try to help make sure those 80,000 Minnesotans that are behind on rent through no fault of their own, many of them or most of them are able to catch up. And then we need an orderly, legislative, thoughtful conclusion to the eviction moratorium to prevent a wave of evictions. And I know there's legislation been introduced to look at that, but that just seems so pivotal given the testimony that we've heard today. And just to remind folks of the study a bit, I believe the chair has mentioned it, the current eviction moratorium has saved lives in Minnesota. And there was a study in of 27 other states that attributed the end of those eviction moratoriums to more than 10,000 deaths from COVID. And so as we continue to come out on the other side of this public health crisis, we absolutely need to do everything we can to help people stay in their homes.
It's so interrelated, aren't they? Mr. Wirth?
Madam Chair, next on the list is Representative Tice.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish we would have had somebody on the other side of the issue talk as well, and somebody from our groups that represent the landlords. My husband and I have rental property, and some of the things I'm hearing, quite frankly, make me very concerned, especially in light of the emails that I've been receiving from housing providers that are saying, you know, people aren't paying their rent. They're getting monies from the government to do so. They aren't applying for them. I was really encouraged to hear Commissioner Ho say that something at least they're going to include in maybe any further monies that come out, that we are including the landlords, that they are able to apply for relief with the tenant. The biggest part of this is I don't think we focus enough on landlord-tenant relationships and building those relationships. What I hear a lot of is we have a lot of good landlords, but then we hear about how horrendous it sounds like everybody is. That dialogue really makes me feel like we're going to lose a lot of our housing providers. If they don't have the money to pay the mortgages, if they don't have the money to do these things, we're going to lose our housing. And we don't have the opportunity to come up with anything new because we can't figure out how to do it affordably. So I really wish we could have a better conversation about how do we get the two groups together so that we have a better bond, that we're not just saying landlords are evil and that's the way it is. We have a lot of good landlords, a lot of good landlords, and they are not doing as well as we had hoped they would be doing. That is very concerning to me. So when you talk about evictions, talking to one gentleman in my area, he has a person in a single family home right now who is not being respectful of that home. It's going to cost him thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to fix it. The gentleman's lease has expired, but he can't evict him. Knowing that, it's going to cost him a lot of money to get that unit back up into the rental market. That makes the cost of housing go up. Somebody's got to pay for it. He can't absorb it, especially in these times. So I really hope that we look at how do we teach people to take better care of and have a partnership with their landlords rather than just saying we need to legislate, because you're going to legislate also on these folks who are doing a great job. And they're going to say, you know what? I don't want to deal with this anymore, and we're going to lose housing. That's exactly how I feel. And I will tell you that my husband and I have felt that way at times. We work really hard with our tenants. We work with them. We have great communication. It took a while, but we have told them, if you can't make your rent or if you have something coming up, please contact us. And they do. We've had Alicia in her house for 12 years. She's got four children. Her oldest one is in the armed forces right now. But and then we've got Tiffany, who we have worked with several times because she has both of them are single moms, but she has one or two daughters that have heart issues. And she has worked with us many times. This works. Having these partnerships and encouraging these partnerships works, because we know, they know, you know, we've had times where they say, well, I can't pay you until the 15th. And then when my husband goes to collect the rent, and he goes because he likes to do some maintenance things as well, like change furnace filters and do some of the other things and look at them. But not only did she pay her rent for that month, but she also included the check for the next month. We need to work at having those relationships. We work really hard on making sure we have those relationships. And I wish we'd have better dialogue and ways that we could do that. I'm just really, really I guess, disappointed that we aren't seeing somebody here from the landlord side of the perspective, and just us that are on the committee that are. It's a heavy burden. It's a heavy burden. If I don't get rent, I have to pay the late charges when I can't pay property tax on time. If I have to replace a refrigerator, a refrigerator that's a year old, because the seal is broken and this refrigerator has a problem with that, and I can't get a seal in time for the inspector to do it. We almost had a tenant evicted because of that, because we couldn't get a seal on a refrigerator. There's a lot of things that need to get fixed. I realize that, but there are a lot of things that landlords have to do constantly. One of the folks does have a dog who regularly ruins the screens on the windows. I have to fix that. Does it sometimes take time? Yeah, it does. I mean, it's not just, you can't just do everything at the drop of a hat. And when it comes time for inspections, when you talk about landlords going in, we try to be very respectful of their privacy, but we have to get inspectors in. We have to get inspectors in, or we're on the line for that. We try to make it as clear as we can, but unfortunately, inspectors also want to come in during the day while she works. And I don't want her to take off half a day because that's the timeline they give her. So there's a lot of different things that work and play with, you know, we basically text or called and said, hey, we have to get in today, you know, but they have a dog that we're not comfortable with. So sometimes there is a lot of things that go into what happens, and it's last minute. If I don't go in, you're going to get evicted because I can't get it inspected. So I really want to bring forth that there's a lot of things on the landlord side that we're not hearing about today. And I wish we would, because I think that would bring a better dialogue about how we can do legislation working together, helping these partnerships grow. Because if we want to continue with our housing providers and having the housing available, we can't just make them the devil. There's a lot of good ones. And every single one of us will tell you, we are absolutely aware that there are really bad folks out there that own homes. I get it. I really do. And it makes us all look bad. But I'm really afraid of what we're going to do to the good landlords. The really, really good landlords we have out there. The many of them. And at the same time trying to punish, but making it a big blanket. So maybe if we put in, you know, if this happens and this happens, then the landlord gets it. But then he gets whatever he needs to have done. I get that. But evictions are not cheap. And you're evicting because you don't have payment most of the time, or else they're ruining the home. We evicted somebody after 3 months. It took us a huge dumpster and thousands of dollars after only 3 months of them being in that unit. It was, I'm not kidding you guys. This was in the late 90s, and it was to the point where the folks that were cleaning it had to wear almost hazmat suits. There's a lot of things landlords go through, a lot of things they have to clean up after folks leave, and a lot of money that takes to get that unit back up again in order to put it back on the market. So I guess I hope, Madam Chair, that we do hear from the landlord side of it. I hope that we hear some of the things that they feel we could probably work together on. And I'm sure everyone would say, I would like to see something where we can form partnerships and educate each other so that we don't have to go through all these things. I'm really afraid we're going to lose our housing providers and our housing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative, did you have experience either personally or in your conversations this last year with our housing assistance, which I understand was supposed to go directly to landlords to assure that rents were paid? Did you feel that worked? Did you have any personal experience with our state housing assistance?
Madam Chair, for most folks, it worked well, but there were always a couple people. One gentleman had a woman move in the 1st of March, and when I talked to him in September, October, he hadn't received any monies yet. Nothing. So she was down, what, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000? You know, he just wasn't seeing any money. He did have some folks that were, he had more folks that he was working with, realizing that the money was to come. And so that was really, you know, he was more encouraged by that. But his latest one is the gentleman whose lease has run out and hasn't seen any money from him. And he's like, he is so sick because it's going to cost him a lot of time and money. He's going to lose another 4 to 5 months rent just getting the house back in shape again. So that's a lot of the things that they
see. So the tenant didn't apply for the housing assistance that was available. Got it.
Correct, Madam Chair. And after talking to Commissioner Ho, it sounds like that's something they're going to do a better job with coming up, just making sure that the landlord can apply on behalf of the tenant with the tenant's signature.
Got it. Who would like to respond? Any response from testifiers?
Madam Chair and Representative Tice,
Mr. McDonough,
briefly. Thank you. I feel like I've been a good landlord over the years. I've never been sued, which is, you know, knock on wood, and I've never had to file an eviction case. I think that's a little bit of luck there. And just in terms of the landlord who's experiencing significant damage as a result of a tenant, that is an exception to the eviction moratorium right now. There are several exceptions for what I consider to be nastier cases, like substantial endangerment of others and significant damage to property. So it could be that landlord actually has an option to deal with that tenant right now.
Thank you.
I could also add, Madam Chairman.
Is that Ms.
Karen? Yes. So I just wanted to add that, you know, we at HomeLine do trainings for both landlords, tenants, and just the community in general. And yesterday we had one. So we are, in fact, hearing from these good landlords. We had the 90-minute training yesterday. And, you know, with landlord attorneys and over 300 landlords, tenants, and they asked, you know, dozens of really good questions and provided a lot of really good feedback to be able to create this partnership that Representative Tice is looking for. You know, we offer these free webinars since April, and they are being attended by both landlords and tenants. So we are trying to build those bridges, and we would most definitely be happy to work with you, Representative Tice, in this matter.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a quick
comment. Is that Ms. Dobson?
No, Tama.
Oh, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, thank you. And, you know, Mr. McDonough, I would say that we've only had one eviction. And, you know, we've really been very lucky. And I will say that we do some screening, but we typically will ask them, well, why is this there? And what's happening now? And I wish more folks would do that. We had a woman that applied and she had a felony on her record. And Greg asked her, and this was probably early 2000. And she said, well, you know, in the 80s, I was in a bad relationship and I hit a guy, you know, and they laughed about it. And that's the kind of information that I hope people are, you know, let's talk about it. If you haven't paid rent, why? Tell me why. And then we'll do a better job at making sure that you're okay. So I really appreciate the comments that were made. Yeah, we have a lot of work to do in that respect. And I'd love to work on getting a better dialogue, better communication, better education, that whole thing. And I think that's where we will do the best work, is when we can have partnerships rather than everybody feeling like they have to fight each other. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Worth, how many more questions do we have?
We have two questions on the list. First, Representative Agbaje, and then Representative Hassan.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to all of the testifiers today. I think very important testimony. I had a couple of questions. I'll try to keep them brief, and hopefully the answers will be brief as well. But one thing that came up, I think Dr. Lewis talked about this a little bit, is some of the evasion, using non-payment of rent as an eviction tactic to kind of evade the retaliation protections that are in the law for tenants. So, you know, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more on the needs for maybe to better protect tenants in the non-payment of rent case, especially, as you said, Dr. Lewis, the reason why people don't make the rent oftentimes has very little to do with just saying, you know, I don't want to pay today.
Dr. Lewis, are you still on?
Or Madam Chair, if Mr. McDonough wants to take that too.
So what she pointed out was sometimes they withhold the rent for another purpose. Means kind of calling attention to an additional problem there. I'm not sure if anyone's prepared to speak to that.
Madam Chair and
Mr. McDonough.
I can give that a shot. One of the things our Minnesota Supreme Court did in the last year is recognize a principle of a common law right to challenge retaliation. And I think that might help in this regard, is that the statutes that we have on retaliation have been fairly limited in their application. And this new decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Olson decision about a year ago extends that out. So it raises the possibility that if the tenant can show that the landlord is actually retaliating in the context of a non-payment of rent case, that the court can grant some relief to the tenant. It's a very new decision, and so it's still a little early to see how that will kind of filter through the court system.
Representative Agbaji?
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. McDonough, for that answer. I think that starts to get at the issue. One other thing I also wanted to bring up, particularly Ms. Dobson spoke on this a little bit, is the fact that many tenants just don't have access to attorneys oftentimes, especially with the quick turnaround of the summary proceedings. And so I was wondering if Ms. Dobson or even Mr. McDonough could speak a little bit more to the kind of the disparities that we see there and how that continues to exacerbate a number of the equity issues that we're seeing in the landlord-tenant space.
Ms. Dobson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative, for that question. And I think it's related to the question you just asked in response to Dr. Lewis's testimony. And what Dr. Lewis testified to based on her quantitative and qualitative research is so true from my experience representing on eviction cases, is that there's often so much more underlying the rent issue. As Representative Tice, you mentioned, most landlords don't just rush to court for 1 or 2 months unpaid. They often work with them. And so usually by the time it gets to an eviction court, there might be some money owed, but there's probably also been a more fundamental breakdown in the relationship due to some other issues. And so I think both of these questions that you're bringing up are related, and that what we need then in the court system is the time and resources to get at those underlying issues if it has come to the point where the case is in court, whether that's time for both sides to get the legal counsel they need about their rights and responsibilities, and just time to bring forth this evidence of these issues that might be at play, whether it's a health and safety risk in the home, whether it's a domestic violence component that the family is facing or something else. So I think these are interrelated pieces, and the disparity on representation is significant. Because for hiring a private attorney is expensive, and a vast majority of renters face eviction court without a lawyer, and most landlords are able, many show up on their own, as especially the individual proprietors, but many, if not most, are represented by a professional agent or professional management, someone for whom this is their job. If not an attorney that's representing them as counsel. So thank you for those questions.
Final question, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I missed part of the presentation today because I had a bill in education finance, but I wanted just to comment. I've been working on tenant rights for the last 2 years that I've been in the House, and I'll continue to work on this. And I have worked as a housing advocate, and I have been to housing court. It's the most depressing place to be. Most tenants that come through that even know what's happening. They got a letter from court. They show up. Many of the, you know, landlords show up with a lawyer, especially if it's, you know, a company. And as you know, they walk away with eviction and their record. Many don't know that they can, you know, hire somebody or that they can get, you know, three lawyers to accompany them to this appointment. I have worked with people who got a letter that says eviction has been filed on them. They have to show up at court because they don't speak English. They didn't know what the letter was. By the time the letter got to me, you know, court date was passed. So then it was no show. And then that eviction was just on their record. So there are a lot of complicated issues around landlord and tenant issues. I love good tenant, landlords. I'll tell you that, Representative Tamatize, I want to see every landlord to be a good landlord so then we can continue, you know, housing everybody because no one wants an eviction in their record. Yes, there are some tenants who are, you know, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that's what, you know, agencies that work on housing, rights and housing advocacy can help with that. So I would love to continue working with landlords to make sure that the laws that we're putting in place do not harm good landlords, but capture bad landlords who are taking advantage of poor, Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, who many of them, this is above their head. They're struggling with daily life. They don't have time to show up at court. They don't have the money to hire a lawyer. This is not in their radar. And before you know it, they can't rent another apartment or they can't just, you know, move from a landlord who's abusing them because they already filed an eviction on them and that they can't find another place. So I think there's a lot of conversation that needs to happen, but there's a lot of advocacy. I know, you know, the part of the landlords is covered because many of them have lawyers, but the part of the tenants are not covered. And that's why we're working on this tenant rights issues. But I welcome the idea of talking to any landlord who wants to continue being a good landlord and providing, you know, housing to our, you know, community. Thank you.
Thank you, members and testifiers. More to come on this subject, clearly. Our next meeting will be Thursday, January 28 at 10:30 a.m. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.